Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, Nick Broomfield, the filmmaker, will be telling us about his new Leonard Cohen documentary, Mariana and Leonard.
Then, with the long list for the Booker Prize announced this week, we'll be hearing from author and critic Louise Doughty, herself a former judge for the contest, about why literary prizes still matter.
And we'll be speaking to writer Richard King, whose new book, The Lark Ascending, explores the relationship between the UK's countryside and the music it helps inspire.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's news editor Peter Firth will be looking ahead to next week's news. And we'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Hello, Og. How are you?
Very well.
It's been a pretty hot week, huh?
Steamy. Not steamy, though. Dry.
I quite enjoy it. I mean, there's some people that hate it, but to be honest, I think you went to the park as well, like to enjoy at least 20 minutes of 38 degrees sun.
I got a full 45. I see your shorts are getting ever shorter.
Yeah, I mean, what can I do? I mean, time now to look to the week ahead with Monocle's Peter Firth. Peter, how exciting you're here. So tell us, you have three new stories for us, right?
Oh, hello, chaps. Yes, I do. So this week on the news desk, we will have our eyes trained on various rumblings from across the world. The first story that we'll be reporting on kicks off on Monday. Now, it's a slightly worrying start to the week, as you mentioned, or following on from last week, because the 29th of July will be 2019's Earth Overshoot Day.
Go on.
So that is the day in the year when we will supposedly have used up all the resources that the Earth's ecosystem can provide and replenish the following year. So it's like we're running on deficit.
Right. So we're on fumes now. We've used the fumes. We've gone past the fumes.
We're into the reserve tank.
Okay.
Next year's tank.
And I presume this date is getting earlier and earlier, right?
It is, Faye. Last year it was on August the 1st. So in 2018, August the 1st, and it is receding. It's getting earlier and earlier each year as our voracious consumption levels continue unchecked.
So how are we going to mark this day, Peter?
Well, obviously it's going to be a day of intense collective mourning. But what's kind of interesting about this is whether or not we believe the statistics. I mean, it's the Global Footprint Network, which is a think tank who apparently get their data from the UN. So far, so good. But it's almost about what it does in the mind of people, in a sense. It's kind of like, you know, the notion of running on a deficit, running on fumes, is hoped to galvanize people into action.
Well, this is exactly it, right? We frequently have these milestones. Certainly in London, within the first couple of weeks of January, we encounter the limit for the air pollution on Oxford Street in a year. You know, these things are made up quite quickly, and they are largely symbolic, but they do have this kind of quite useful resonance in the mind of the public in terms of just centering these quite important issues, don't they?
Absolutely. I think there's almost a listicle style article we could do there somewhere about, you know, the most frightening images associated with all our impending doom.
There you go. You've got an idea for the October issue. Let's move on to the next story.
Something a bit cheerier, perhaps?
Ah, yeah, cheerier. Good. Right. Did somebody say trade talks between the US and China?
Love it.
About time.
All right. Okay. So on Tuesday and Wednesday, the latest round of Sino-US trade talks are scheduled to get underway in Shanghai. So Trade Representative Robert Leitziger and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, they're whipping over to Shanghai to chat with some of their contemporaries over there. So there is the intention to end this enduring trade war, I think, because actually, really, it's becoming a bit of a slugging match now. And it's going on, and it's kind of who's going to blink first. The fact that the two sides are actually even talking face-to-face is quite a positive step. So this is the first time that they've met face-to-face between, well, the US and China since Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping agreed at the G20 summit in Japan to revive these talks.
I mean, this is, you called it a slugging match, and it is how it's starting to feel. This has got to be round, what, 50 of the talks or something like that? It's starting to kind of resemble one of those epic Wimbledon matches that just goes on for 18 hours, set point after set point and all that.
God, yeah, kind of advantage after advantage. But yeah, the question is, who is Federer in this and who is Djokovic?
I mean, they should sort it out soon, because I think this could have serious implications to the world economy as well if they keep
Yeah. Of this spat.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Worrying stuff. Please tell me that you've got either a mass nudist gathering or a Father Christmas extravaganza. Something. Something, Peter.
We've got the Edinburgh Fringe Festival kicking off this week. So thespians will be delighted as the city streets are transformed with street theatre troupes, travelling thespians, poetry.
Something in your tone, Peter, tells me that you yourself are not such a fan of the performing arts.
I was spurned by the performing arts org when I was at school. I had a budding joy for drama and theatre studies, but it was knocked out of me, actually, when the theatre burnt down.
A sad tale.
Traumatic.
Very traumatic.
Indeed.
What's your view on Edinburgh, by the way? It's quite a nice city to host such a festival, no?
So I think Edinburgh is really interesting because it's almost like every single year somehow Edinburgh Fringe Festival is politicised in some way, one way or another. I mean, last year we saw the controversy, I think it was the Edinburgh Book Fair, which happens just afterwards, where there was a question over visas for Brexit, because there was the question that many famous authors would not be allowed entry into the UK. Mm. So it's kind of interesting to see whether this year it will pass without incident or not.
Peter, thank you so much, as ever, for joining us. You're all listening to The Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing from documentary maker Nick Broomfield. Don't go away.
Nick Broomfield is widely regarded as one of the most influential documentary makers working in the last 30 years. His lo-fi style, often including himself in the narrative of his documentaries, echoes in the work of filmmakers like Louis Theroux and Morgan Spurlock.
Broomfield's latest film, Mariana and Leonard, Words of Love, focuses on the bittersweet and years-long romance between songwriter Leonard Cohen and his muse, Mariana Illen. A touching tale, it's given real depth by Broomfield's connection to the subject matter. He met Mariana on the idyllic Greek island of Idra as a young man. I sat down with Nick to learn more about the film, but first, here's a clip of what might be the most famous, but certainly isn't the only, song Leonard wrote for Mariana. For so long. For a lot of people, it kind of begins with this song, So Long, Marianne, which is maybe what people will be most familiar with, and then ends with the letter that Leonard Cohen famously wrote to Mariana when she was on her deathbed. Did that kind of provide you with a very natural sort of framework for the film?
Yeah, I guess so. When I originally thought of doing a film about their relationship, well, I didn't know that there was that footage of Marianne on her deathbed being read the note. I knew about the note, and it did seem obviously an ending or a resolution of sorts. And I also didn't know that I was going to find that Pennybaker footage, which is very much the heart and soul of Mariana. I mean, I'm just saying this because I think often people imagine that you have done all this research and you know all these things before you start the film. But I think, particularly making documentaries, it's kind of a bit like a Wild West show. You decide what you want to make a film about, and you then kind of just see what you can get to support that storyline, which is why I think in documentary you don't want to have too firm a storyline, because you might have to change it depending on what you find that you actually have, you know.
And there is some incredible footage in the film. There's this amazing bit where Leonard Cohen is playing a concert in Jerusalem that I've kind of heard about anecdotally, and I think maybe other Leonard Cohen fans will have heard him talk about it as this formative moment. But then, you know, we see him backstage shaving and taking even more LSD and kind of trying to pull himself into shape to do this performance. What was the process of sourcing this material like? I mean, was there a kind of an embarrassment of riches, or did you find yourselves kind of...
There was very little material on Idra, because it was before people were, obviously, people didn't have phones and people weren't shooting that kind of film. And I was lucky that D.A. Pennybaker kind of used 16mm like most people use their phones. I mean, a lot of it is knowing the relevance of material. And so, for example, we did the interview with Ron Cornelius, who was in Jerusalem with Leonard and was able to tell the story about the shaving. Otherwise, you just kind of have a scene of someone shaving and you don't really know the relevance of it. So a lot of the actual structure of the film came from the interviews that we were doing. Like, I think Ron Cornelius also talked about the love-in that happened on stage with Leonard, because Leonard liked to be so close to the audience that he would literally kind of have a love-in with their clothes on, but, you know, he would exceed the normal bounds of, I guess, performer audience participation. So you kind of then got a sense of the relevance of what you wanted. Like, we heard about the mental asylum footage, which is, you know, Leonard would play in mental institutions. But it was, again, only when we got the stories about the institution, we actually managed to get the material of Leonard playing there. And this was the first time the institution had ever allowed the material out, that we were really, again, able to use it in a sort of meaningful way.
You, of course, visited Ida in the late 60s and struck up a kind of relationship with Mariana that would turn into an acquaintanceship that lasted for many years.
I was mesmerized by the island's beauty and had never before met so many golden, sun-kissed people of either sex having so much fun together. It felt like anything was possible. Marianne gave me my first acid trip, which she said had come from a friend of Leonard's in London called Malcolm.
Was this idea of the film something that kind of came to you when they both passed away and when you were reflecting on your memories of her? How did it kind of come together?
Yeah, the idea of a film about them and their relationship really came out of a real, actually sort of, I suppose, shock that they both died. They were so formative in my development. I mean, I think going to Idra and meeting Mariana and sort of falling head over heels in love with Mariana at the tender age of 20 was a real turning point in my life. You know, I was kind of reading law at that time, and she convinced me I should try and make a film, and I ended up changing universities. And, you know, it was a time of great change. Change is not always comfortable. Change is also a little traumatic. So it was a big upheaval, but I think a very positive one. So I was very grateful for that. And then when they both died, I thought, you know, I suppose like anybody else, you always wish you'd had a few more conversations and you'd spent more time. And why are you so caught up in your own little life rather than making more of the people you already know? And I just felt I wanted to go back to that period of my life and also reacquaint myself with some of my friends from that time that I've sort of a bit lost touch with.
The island is presented as this place of two halves, which is on the one hand a kind of amazing artist utopia, sort of mesmerizing, that captures people and they find it difficult to leave. And at the same time, it has this quite intense underbelly with people taking a lot of hallucinogenic drugs, people becoming maybe a bit burnt out and it really taking a toll on their lives. When you were there, was that a sense that you got from the island? Were you there long enough? Did you feel this kind of darkness there?
When I was on Idra then, I only just thought this is paradise and I'll return here and I'll live here at some point. And it seemed like a wonderful alternative lifestyle to the one that I'd grown up with, and it seemed so simple and so perfect, and everyone could run around barefoot, there were no cars, there were just mules, and kids could go to the Greek schools, and it felt like the kind of center of the universe, although it was incredibly simple and incredibly beautiful. I kind of encouraged my best friend, who's called Richard Vick, from school, to go there for a holiday. He was a journalist and pretty exhausted, and he ended up spending like 14 years there, and I would visit him occasionally in the intervening years. And I noticed, you know, I think Rick was a fairly hard drinker when we were at college together. At least I never got anywhere near as drunk with anybody else. But I think the cheap Brezina and the abundance of beautiful women that trope through there, all kind of added to, well, he had a great time there, but I think it probably in the long term didn't necessarily do him a fantastic amount of good. And he's very reflective in the film about this. I think he felt that you needed a kind of iron discipline, which is what Leonard had, to really get the best of Idra and not sort of succumb to it, you know, like a siren that is kind of beckoning you and into lure you and to sort of rob you of your focus and vitality.
It's true that all the men you knew were dealers who said they were through with dealing every time you gave them shelter. I know that kind of man. It's hard to hold the hand of anyone who's reaching for the sky just to surrender.
Leonard had this focus, as you say, and seemed to have this kind of charisma in the truest sense of the word. It was very beguiling, it comes out in the film. And he seems to beguile a lot of people. I wonder if you feel that he beguiled Marianne, and if he was conscious of this ability and was also careful to use it well, or if he didn't always use it well.
I didn't really feel I was in judgment on this film at all. So most of the descriptions and most of the definitions are either supplied by Marianne or Leonard, really. I mean, obviously, there's, you know, a few other people throwing in some comments. But I think, you know, Leonard talks very truthfully about his sexual proclivities and what he got up to. And I don't know whether I would add whether he used it well or not. It's just who he was. And he certainly used it all well in his work. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I think he was extremely honest about who he was, and I think that's what made his work so strong. But I didn't really feel, as a filmmaker, it was my job to kind of cast judgment on him. Or I think we live in a very judgmental time where things are seen in a very black and white way, and I think the film is full of shades of gray, and there are lots of textures and contradictions, as there are, you know. And I think we kind of, it's very tempting to oversimplify everything to the point where it no longer makes any real sense.
How did your sense of these two individuals change from how you'd known them versus kind of assimilating this information that was in the public sphere and researching through friends? How did you come, to see them as in any way different than the impression you'd held before?
Well, I think their relationship was fairly complicated. As with most relationships, I think the sort of balance of power shifted from one to the other. One of the things making a film is you spend a year or a year and a half thinking incredibly intensely about somebody. So you realize lots and lots of things that you wouldn't have realized before. I think, you know, Marianne was very self-effacing, very humble, never really appreciated the amazing talent that she had, which was kind of spotting the real talent in other people and their greatness and honing in on that talent and encouraging them to exploit that, which I guess she did with Leonard and his music, and encouraging a lot of other musicians to write their own songs for the first time, encouraging me to take up filmmaking. But I think she was very tough on herself, and she always felt that she needed a very specific talent, like being a writer or a painter or something. In a sense, her talent wasn't very different from a great record producer like Rick Rubin, who makes countless millions, encouraging various artists to follow a particular path or a particular line. And I guess at that time, it wouldn't have occurred to her to make money from her talent. And I think in this time that we live in, it's very easy for people to be quite judgmental because everything is about money or people monetarizing their talents. You know, the term of muse, which is a very 18th century term, doesn't really reflect, I think, her true talent. I think people probably knew, you know, Leonard a lot better. There's been a lot written on him, and he obviously wrote a lot about himself. I guess, you know, the discipline, the humor, all those kinds of sides of him. And I think his, you know, he was very generous to a lot of people, which is something I think that he didn't bandy about. But I met a lot of people who had benefited from his generosity in their lives.
More broadly, when you engage with a subject like this, or like Eileen Wuornos, or like Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love, when you set out to make these films, what do you want from the process beyond a strong documentary at the end?
You know, nothing specific like that at all, other than being interested myself. You never really know. I never knew what my relationship with Eileen Wuornos was going to be like. I don't think you go into making a film for that reason. I think you go in because it's a voyage of discovery, and it's an adventure, and because you're interested. You know, it's much more like being an explorer, I think, than you never know what you're going to find.
Broomfield there, speaking to you, Og, and Nick's new film, Marianne and Leonard, Words of Love, is out now.
It's time for a tune. Of course, it can only be one thing. Here's the great Leonard Cohen with Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye.
I loved you in the morning, our kisses deep and warm, your hair upon the pillow like a sleepy golden storm. Yes, many love before us, I know that we are not new in city.
Leonard Cohen there from 1967 with Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24.
The nominations for the Booker Prize are announced this week. The prize for fiction writers is seen as an almost assured fast track to literature's top table, and also provides a substantial paycheck for the winning author. This year's list is dominated by big names, including Salman Rushdie and Margaret Atwood, and also some more recent emerging talents such as Max Porter.
Author Louise Doughty has published 9 novels, including the upcoming Platform 7 and the bestseller Apple 3 Yard, which has been adapted for television. And she's also been a past judge for the Booker Prize itself.
A little earlier, she joined Monocle's Georgina Godwin to discuss the prize, and they began by talking about how you become a judge for the Booker in the first place.
Well, I don't know. I don't know why I was asked. I was very flattered to be asked, I have to say. It was Ion Truin, sadly no longer with us, who used to run the prize, who sidled up to me at a party and said, "Oh, Louise, you're saving me an email. I'm glad I've bumped into you." And then said in a rather loud, boomy voice, "We'd like you to be a Booker judge. Don't tell anyone, will you?" And I think at least a dozen people around me heard. What was most extraordinary about that experience for me, actually, well, A, was how popular I became. A lot of people said hello to me very brightly and very friendly. But also the way I would be followed around parties or literary events by diarists, sort of hovering at my elbow, waiting to see if I let something slip. And the day that the shortlist came out, we announced it at a big, very glossy Man Group building, who were then the sponsors. And I was sort of whisked out of the foyer before any of the journalists could hear me, taken upstairs. It was a big press conference, and we announced the shortlist, and journalists sort of rushed melodramatically for the door to file their pieces. It was one of the first experiences where anything bookish I'd been involved in crossed over from the literary world onto the news pages. For instance, Salman Rushdie had been on our long list, but we didn't shortlist him. And I saw a headline in, I think it was the New York Times, which was something like, "Booker judges snub Rushdie." It's like, we didn't snub him. We just liked his book, not enough to put on the shortlist. It was so the press coverage of it was quite something.
Mm. So the process is you whittle it down to the Booker dozen, which is 13, and then to another 6, and then, of course, the final winner. How does that work, though, in practice?
Well, the chair of judges in my year was Michael Portillo. There's a good reason why they often have politicians, I think, to chairs. They're very good at chairing. He was very well organised. We had a series of meetings throughout the year where we discussed whatever book we felt like discussing. There wasn't much agenda. We were all reading all of the books. And then before the long list meeting, he invited us all to send him a list of our top 10 independently, without any consultation with the others, just our 10 favourite books that we would really like on the long list.
And you'd read every single one of them?
Well, of the 10, yes. Well, but no, of every single entry. I'd read enough of every single book to know whether it was a contender, let's put it that way. Yeah. But obviously, when you've got 130 to read, if after 50 or 100 pages, you're thinking there's no chance this is going to be in the top 13, then you've got better things to do, quite frankly. But what was interesting was when Michael Portillo got that list, he did a spreadsheet and there were 9 books where 3, 4, or 5 judges all wanted them on the long list, which is amazing. If you think that although we'd had a series of meetings and lots of chat, we hadn't consulted each other about our top 10 and there were 9 books where a majority of judges were behind them. So he said, right, I propose that those 9 are all going to go on our long list straight away. And that actually meant we only had 4 places then to fill. And we looked at the books that had 2 votes out of the 5 judges. We talked about, you know, if there were any of us particularly objected to. So it was actually a very clever way of doing it. I think each chair of judges can do it his or her own way. Mm-hmm. But it meant that the majority of our long list, there was a great deal of unanimity over. Whittling it down was the hard thing, I have to say.
And how did you do that?
Well, we just had a meeting. We had a shortlist meeting. And there were certain books that hopped onto the shortlist pretty readily. And then again, it was a matter of arguing over the remaining places. So I think by the time it came to the final meeting, we were all pretty clear which 2 or 3 books were really up there. And we did get it down to 2 fairly readily. And then there was a lot of argy-bargy. There was a very close runner-up. What was interesting, I think, was how passionately we all felt. We had a lot of very serious, very earnest, very passionate discussion, not only about the individual novels, but about what is fiction for? What is the nature of art? Is it to tell us truth? Is it to show beauty? Does it have to do both to be great art? It was a really very rewarding experience and something I feel very privileged to have done.
As a writer yourself, presumably you knew a lot of the authors too. And I'm not asking if that influenced you in terms of I want to do my friend a favour, but knowing the character of the writer, did that have any bearing?
No, not at all. What was really interesting is how quickly, once you started a novel, all those other considerations fell away. And yes, obviously, the books come in their printed form, the name of the author's on the jacket, some you know, some you don't know. But the minute you start a book, I just found it was all about the prose. It was all about the writing in there. And just other considerations didn't really figure at all. And obviously, I can't speak for my fellow judges, but I think they probably felt pretty much the same way. Our arguments were all about the quality of people's prose. And we didn't take anything else into consideration.
And once you've read a book a few times, which you must have done by the time it got down to the winner, does story cease to become important? Because, of course, you know the plot by then.
You do. And certainly if there are any surprises in the plot, obviously the third time you read it, it's not a surprise anymore. I think a lot of what it comes down to at that stage is an acknowledgement that when you're down to the last 6, or even when you're down to the last 13, personal preference plays a huge part. And I've judged a lot of other prizes now as well. And I would say there's quite a strong rule of thumb, which is in any given prize, there's roughly the top quarter that I feel I could defend purely on terms of quality. There's a top quarter of books that go, guess what, I'm a potential prize winner. And narrowing it down to that top quarter is quite easy. The others fall away pretty rapidly. But once you've got that top quarter, it's very, very hard. Because at that stage, the books are roughly level pegging. You know, it depends what sort of book you like, where you might like one or the other. And personal preference really comes into it. And the great thing about judging the Booker Prize is it did cure me of any delusions about ever winning one of those big prizes myself, because I realized what you want to know, I think, as an author is, was I in that top quarter? Was I considered? Because that's about the quality. Once you're there, it's all about the personal preference of the individual judges on the panel. And there's no way you can predict that. And there's no way your publisher can either.
Yeah. So, I mean, the same books could go up against two different juries and get completely different
Absolutely.
Results.
Absolutely. Yeah. The Booker jury changes every year, as most prize panels do. And every single year, with the previous year's set of judges or the next year's, you'd get a completely different result. So yeah. I think learning to be philosophical about prizes is a really important part of being a writer.
And finally, what does it mean, not just for the writer, but also for the publisher? I mean, I know small indies. So, for instance, Canongate absolutely rocketed once Life of Pi won.
Absolutely, yes. And I think that's very, very true. And I think you're aware of it as a judge, because you do know that you are anointing somebody. If you give them the Man Booker Prize, you're probably turning them into a millionaire, and you are changing the entire course of their career. And of course, the corollary of that is you're not anointing the people you don't give it to. So it's a very, very serious business. And I think there is an interesting debate to be had about really what it's like for novelists, I think, because you know it can make so much difference. I mean, for many novelists, it can make the difference between their next book being published or not. Winning a prize or even being shortlisted can be a career-rescuing event, and not getting it can be a career-ending event. So people tend to slightly take the mickey out of novelists yearning for prizes, but it's hard. It's a difficult business. We do live in a winner-takes-all culture. And there are plenty of novelists who mid-career have just drifted away because their books have not been successful, they've not been recognised, and they can't get published anymore. And a prize can stop that process in its tracks. So I think there's quite an interesting debate to be had about how we have a more pluralistic culture, because it does tend to be the same names again and again once you've achieved a certain status. As the writer Maggie G said, a novelist wins more prizes. Their name comes easily to everybody's lips. They win more prizes. This doesn't prove they are good, merely successful. And that's an inevitable result. But what's the alternative if, you know, prizes are such an important part of promoting books to the wider public? I think that the good they do and the publicity they garner and the press coverage, that's got to outweigh the difficulties it causes for us cannon fodder at the other end of the process, slogging away at our unrewarded books.
Louise Doughty there speaking to Georgina Godwin. And do keep an eye out for Louise's book, Platform 7, arriving later this August. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Get ready to take a tour of the most vibrant, thriving and altogether lovable cities around the world in Monocle's bumper July-August issue. First up, our annual Quality of Life survey ranks the top 25 most livable cities from Amsterdam to Zurich. We have a new winner this year. How did your city rank? On to the business section, where we take a look at the best locations to set up shop. As our visits to Porto, Thessaloniki and Bari show, you needn't pay more to live better. Then we prime you for a cultured holiday with our Summer 100, an essential list of galleries to go to, books to buy, cinemas worth seeing and tunes to tune into as the temperatures spike. On the design pages, we get playful in our report on the importance of parks, whereas our inventory is dedicated to six urban waterway-focused itineraries. Finally, we sit down with Pierre Hardy, Hermes Creative Director of Footwear, to ask whether we've reached peak sneaker. Monocle's July-August issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
Author Richard King's books have included How Soon Is Now, which charted the history of the independent music scene in the UK, and Original Rockers, which celebrated the influence of record stores within our cities and beyond.
Now, the writer who's lived in rural Wales for over 20 years returns with The Lark Ascending, the music of the British landscape. It's a loose and exploratory ramble through the last century of British composers, cherry-picking notable pieces that have either caught the spirit of the countryside or simply captured the public's imagination by dreaming of it.
Monocle Stonehall recently spoke to Richard King. He begins things in the early 20th century and Ralph Vaughan Williams' piece The Lark Ascending, from which his book takes its name.
The Lark Ascending was begun shortly before the outbreak of the First World War and completed and premiered two or three years after the end of the war. And it's a very elegiac piece of music. It's a piece of music that is incredibly popular, but also quite mysterious. It's a piece of music that seems to symbolise a sense of yearning, a sense of inhabiting a sort of British equivalent of Eden. And it's a sort of innocent landscape as well, but it's a landscape that can only exist in the listener and the composer's imagination. There's no distinct location. And I think that was what was really interesting to me, was the idea that this piece of music that symbolises our relationship to the countryside could be so popular, but we don't really know where this place is. So I wanted to sort of wander through the century, trying to find pieces of music that had a similar effect on the consciousness as The Lark Ascending. And some of these pieces of music, like The Lark Ascending, are set in a place in the imagination. But I thought by delving into our relationship with the countryside, I could reveal quite a bit about who we are.
I think that's quite interesting, actually, what you've picked up there with just the actual piece itself, because I was just weirdly thinking just a couple of weeks ago about this piece of music, because I heard it and I was like, oh, yeah, I love that. Obviously, like, everyone loves it. And I was just sort of, I had in my brain, like, I know that it's massive. I know that it's incredibly well known. But then when I was reading your book and you were sort of just reeling off these facts, like, you know, it's the most requested song on Desert Island Discs or at people's funerals and stuff, it suddenly occurred to me, like, oh, I kind of just thought it was mine.
Yes.
I knew that it was incredibly evocative of the British landscape and the British nation in some way, but I also somehow just thought only I knew it. It was really strange.
Well, I think that's testimony to the success of it as a composition, and I think that's possibly what Ray Vaughan Williams had in mind, that it was both intensely personal but very much belonging to all of us. So, you know, I was more interested in, rather than nature, what is nature, how is nature, why is nature, and crucially in our culture and in our country, to whom does nature belong to? So I knew it was going to be a book about rights of access, rights of way, laws, trespass, and I knew it was going to be a book where those laws would come into conflict with things we all like to do in the open air, like hedonism, parties, raves, weddings, and in some cases, protest. And I wanted to look at how the book says the landscape is never ours. And I just wanted to look at our relationship, that something that The Lark Ascending articulates so well, which is, it's not nostalgia, it's not patriotism. Many of us have a deep-seated affinity and sense of belonging to this landscape, but it's such a hard thing to achieve other than in a kind of passing emotional phase of a walk or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of like main narratives that I picked out, and obviously I love a rave, but I always kind of saw that as a tension between, say, just party people and the government, whereas really it's got roots way, way back into like the right to ramble and people fighting for access to the land, which has been going on for decades, if not hundreds of years. You know, it was that kind of age-old story of people having to fight to get access to the land, something that you wanted to kind of chime with the book?
Yes, and there were two key moments in the 20th century, two key laws or incidents of the laws being brought to bear on people being outdoors that I think defined our relationship to the land during the century. The first was the Kinder Scout trespass, 1932, April 1932, when 200 or 300 young people, employed, unemployed, did what we now think of as completely normal activity. They went for a walk up in the Peak District, and they came into very, very vague, almost non-eventful conflict with the gamekeeper. I think there was a bit of pushing and shoving. And the leader of the trespass, Benny Rothman, ended up receiving a custodial prison sentence, and there was outcry because trespass, for which he received the sentence, was not a criminal offence. The sign, "Trespassers will be prosecuted," is almost a structure of feeling. It basically says, if we find you trespassing, we'll find a way to punish you. Anyway, the outcry over Kinder Scout was happening at the same time, just before the outbreak of the Second World War, when things like the Youth Hostel Association was coming together, the Ramblers Association was formalised. So there was great public momentum towards freeing the landscape for everyone to inhabit and to use. And obviously, once the Second World War drew to its conclusion, the passing of the National Park and Countryside Act of 1949, I think, is as symbolic as the creation of the NHS and of social housing in terms of the effect it had of building a kind of society in which everyone felt they had agency. So what followed after them really was this reinterpretation of the countryside, which changed again when we joined the common market in 1974 because agriculture received subsidy for the first time. But the second key point was 60 years exactly after Kinderscout, the Castle Morton rave. And in 1992, when 20, 30, 40,000 people spend a weekend raving on some common land in the Malvern Hills, and such was the outcry that within 2 years the Criminal Justice Bill became the Criminal Justice Act. That's always sort of stereotyped and caricatured by the phrase use of repetitive beats to describe dance music, which, yeah, imagine the poor civil servant had to come up with that. But more significantly, it included the offence, aggravated trespass. So the first time in the 20th century, in its final decade, 1994, trespass became criminal.
Right.
That 60-year period is when the landscape was really up for reinterpretation.
And let's talk about some of the actual music in the book, and there is a lot of it. You jump around from everything from Vaughan Williams to Elgar Country to we've got the Penguin Cafe Orchestra in there. We've got, I think, the Raincoats are in there. Hawkwind.
Yeah. Can't write about music in the landscape without the Kings of the Free Festival.
Indeed. So talk us through maybe two or three of some of the really evocative pieces that you managed to find literary inspiration through.
Well, one of the most literary is Stan Tracy's composition, Undermilk Wood Jazz Suite. It was his setting of the radio play by Dylan Thomas. And in particular, there's a tune, Starless and Bible Black, which I think is as evocative of an imaginary landscape as The Lark Ascending. I think it's a wonderful evocation of an imaginary landscape. So I definitely wanted to write about that. I also wanted to write about it because Undermilk Wood was broadcast on the BBC. It was written for the radio, and that was the medium by which many people had learnt about what was happening in the war. And when it was first broadcast in the early 50s, that seemed to me of a piece with things like the Festival of Britain and the building of the welfare state. And Stan Tracy's creation of a British modern jazz music was a similar sort of form of modernism. And one doesn't need to make these sort of comparisons, but I think if British music ever had its kind of blue, it would be Jazz Suite Undermilk Wood.
Talk us through maybe a couple more. What else was on your radar?
Well, I knew I wanted to write about Greenham Common. And the fact that
this is the protest.
This is the women's peace camp. I mean, after 6 months, it was decided men weren't welcome. So I knew I could only write about it with a relatively small degree of authority, as I'm not a woman. But just before the end of his life, Vaughan Williams, one of his last books was an anthology of folk music, which he compiled with A.L. Lloyd, the he was a communist and really wanted to include lots of industrial folk songs like Blackleg Minor, which in the first wave of folk music, the one led by Cecil Sharp, a friend of Vaughan Williams, had been very much a rural, very deeply rural sort of folk music or a coastal folk music. And this volume, which was published in the 50s, which Vaughan Williams and Lloyd did together, had far more industrial songs. And Vaughan Williams was very up and enthusiastic for the inclusion of different types of folk music. And I thought, well, had he lived in a few different decades, I'm sure in his next anthology of folk music, he would have included the songs sung by the women at the Greenham Common Peace Camp as forms of folk music. I'm very convinced of that.
And what was the music specifically that they were kind of...
They made up their own folk songs called things like I Am a Communist Spy and There's a Hole in Your Fence, Dear American Air Force, Dear American Air Force, and I Witness Your War Crimes. But when I visited there to write about the visit in the book, it was a very grey, very cold day. It was midwinter's day, and the camp was set in 1981 is when they set up the camp. And I was thinking of what sort of feminist music was there at the time. And I realised Oddy Shape, the album by Raincoats, was released just almost simultaneous as the time the camp was created, and the person who engineered it, Sister, was the only person to make a documentary about the camp that was approved of by the occupants. And, you know, there's a line in the last song on Oddy Shape, The Landscape is Alive. And I just thought, in terms of a sort of description of the energies at work in the peace camp, Oddy Shape really came very close.
To rejoice, rejoice, 'cause this landscape is alive. The buildings, the clothes, the trees.
The people I spoke to said the factor that really endured for them was what they call co-consciousness, the idea that people lived together, fought together for peace, and survived together. And I wanted to pay tribute to that idea. And for the book, it was significant because this took place on common land, and they were sort of almost psychologically taking on the role of commoners. And in particular, by not having any leaders, that seemed to me very much a form of replicating some of the ideals of commoners and their relationship to the land.
And then as the book comes more up to date, as you've kind of been speaking about, you get into the rave era and Andrew Weatherall and bands like Ultramarine. I wonder, I mean, you write sort of quite beautifully about the experiences of them having their first rave down in East Grinstead and your own experiences as well. I've been to parties out in the countryside and I've seen the sun come up. You do suddenly feel this very connected feeling to something quite sort of primordial, you know, like something very natural, which you weren't even aware was kind of part of the makeup. But I just wonder, when you were really having a proper good time out in the countryside, did you really feel this, you know, this lineage of decades, hundreds of years, or were you kind of thinking about the next 3 hours?
That's a very good question. I definitely remember once going on one of those sort of daybreak, very stupid daybreak drives to go and sit on top of a hay bale.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, I wonder who owns this field and will a farmer... But at that point, I thought all farmers were beautiful.
Right.
So I think maybe... I mean, I was never a huge raver, but I think... No, I think at the time, I'd have been reading romantic literature at university, so I think I always veered towards the fluffy side of things.
It was up in the mountains. We had this ceremony every year. We had it, and everyone from miles around came in for it. Cousins, aunts, uncles, and the kids, grandmothers, grandfathers, everyone.
One of the reasons I wanted to write this book and write about this subject in the book was there was this moment for about 50 years in the middle of the century when the landscape was up for grabs. And it's less up for grabs now than it was then. And something like, we won't name the names, but the more kind of fine dining boutique festivals very much seem to me like a kind of return to some sort of Edwardian idea about how the landscape should be managed and enjoyed.
I was going to ask you one final question, which was going to be this geniusly multi-tiered, complicated thing, where I was going to ask about, do you think there's something in the British psyche about longing for something that just isn't there or something that you can't access, because you talk about The Lark Ascending being a song about nowhere, but it's somewhere that we all want to be, kind of thing.
Mm.
But then actually now I think about it, when you've sort of given me this history lesson of this kind of quite almost glorious period of 50, 60 years when we had access to the land, do you think there's something in the British psyche over the last 30 years of longing for something that is no longer there, something that we can no longer get to, and it's kind of manifesting itself in strange, you know, ideas of nostalgia and things like that?
Well, on one level, I think it's far more acute than that, that we have a longing for a functioning NHS.
Indeed.
So you could point to a hospital, you could point to a train, or you could point to a field. It's the same economic reality for all of those things. But in terms of the British psyche, you know, we're an island, we're surrounded by water. Our urban areas are incredibly dense, and much of the topography of our country is uninhabited. Is, I wouldn't go as far as saying wilderness, but unless George Monbiot gets his way. But we're a very small, built-up island full of empty spaces, and we always have been. So for us not to at least be curious about where we stand in all that, where we fit in, I think would be strange. And it's, you know, it's how do we look to people who can articulate our experience of being outside and of being in the landscape to make us understand quite how it works? Because we're not going to get that information from the landowners themselves. So people look to people like Thomas Hardy at the turn of the last century to explain rural life to them. You know, they read The Woodlanders to understand what these people were doing in these villages they never knew existed away from the highways. And, you know, it's hard. The idea of the green and pleasant land suggests a state of permanence and a fixed certainty, and that the landscape never changes, but it changes all the time. And, you know, it'll change radically in all our lifetimes. And one way of ensuring that we're part of that change is to be in it.
Richard King there speaking to Tone Hall, and Richard's book, The Lark Ascending, The Music of the British Landscape, is out now. You are with the Monaco Weekly.
What a lovely show that was, Faye.
Excellent show, and I really want to see the documentary about Leonard Cohen.
You must see it. It's unmissable, I think.
And we're discussing, like, I became a fan of Leonard Cohen quite late in my life, I should say. But, I mean, he's such a fantastic. His voice is unique, right?
I started early. I was into him at sixth form as a kind of emotional, romantic teenager, and then had a few fallow years and rediscovered him when I had my first quarter-life crisis at 24.
Well, it was a great interview done by you, Og.
Thank you very much.
Well, and that's all for edition 525 of the Monaco Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Nora Hull. The Monaco Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And from me, Augustin Macellari.
Goodbye.
Bye.